are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous, gorgeous planet we call Earth, thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. If you're joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. And be sure you get over to kevinsmithshow.com. That's my website. Now, at kevinsmithshow.com, you'll see in big red letters, K-Files e-zine. You need to subscribe to that. It's absolutely free to subscribe. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. It's our, as I say, our free weekly newsletter. And, you know, we don't give your email address to somebody. We don't let anybody else have it. We don't rent it, lease it, sell it. So it's safe. And you'll be glad you did it, because then you'll no longer be in the dark. You know, there's a big controversy that we addressed on this show as it was happening. And that had to do with the whole deal about, you know, a meeting at the United Nations, a report of a meeting at the United Nations building. This meeting was supposed to have been dealing with the subject of UFO disclosure, remember? Well, you'll remember, as we dealt with that, I was looking at it and sort of analyzing and parsing the evidence, scant as it was, but evidence. And I was saying that while many of the big names, as well as smaller names in ufology, were saying, you know, this is it's probably not true and it's a hoax and so forth. They were saying all of that based on the fact that one of the witnesses, a Frenchman, had some inaccuracies in his resume. And I said that has nothing to do with whether he actually saw and heard what he says he saw and heard. And even if you take him entirely out of the equation, you still have this other source. And the source, although anonymous, we don't know the name, the source talked to two people by the name of Clay and Sean Pickering. Remember? And as the days progressed, we had several shows on this, and we had Dr. Michael Sala, who wrote the report that was out there on the internet, that told about this meeting. We had him on the show. We had Dick Criswell, who said he had talked with a source that is in the military that told him it did happen. The meeting took place. So we had two unnamed sources, and the only names really associated with the story were Michael Sala, who reported it, and then Sean and Clay Pickering. Later, we discovered, also affiliated with that story, was Robert Morningstar, and we have had him on the show. But the closest people to the original source are Sean and Clay Pickering. Well, you know me. I want to get as close to the horse's mouth as possible. And so guess who's going to be my guest this evening? Sean and Clay Pickering will be with me on the other side of the upcoming break, and we're going to be talking with them about this source and about this UFO disclosure meeting at the UN. They'll join me on the other side of the break. Don't go away. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artist from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. Alien Seeker News has blasted off and is providing a new and important resource for everyone interested in UFOs, aliens, alien abductions, Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and more. Featuring five of the top UFO radio talk shows, lots of information and articles in free forums, Alien Seeker News has launched on its journey to greatness. Go to AlienSeekerNews.com, register for the free forums, and get the classic Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe as a free ebook. Join today. Okay, folks, this is what you've been waiting for, your vacation of a lifetime. It awaits your arrival down under in beautiful and historic Hobart, Tasmania. And to make sure your holiday really is a dream come true, you'll be staying at the Bath Street Apartments. Here are just a few of the things that you'll enjoy in your home for the holidays. Stunning water and mountain views from all windows and from your own private balcony or veranda. Modern furnishings, a full modern kitchen with all new appliances, oven and hot plates, fat-free grill, full-size refrigerator, large-capacity microwave oven, cappuccino machine, dishwasher, and enough crockery, cutlery, and utensils to satisfy anyone's culinary desires. The lounge room has an extensive range of electronic home entertainment equipment, including, now get this, a big-screen TV, free digital satellite, pay TV on Foxtel OnStar with over 60 channels, DVD, video, wireless broadband connection, free local telephone calls from the in-room telephone with your own private telephone number so loved ones and friends can call you directly. The bathroom? Wow, the bathroom has a large spa bath, separate shower cubicle, ceiling-mounted heat lamp and fan and hair dryer, and it just gets better and better. Folks, you've got to see Bath Street Apartments. So click the banner over on the Kevin Smith Show website or just go to bathstreetapartments.com.au. Your dreams are awaiting your arrival. Joining me for this evening are two gentlemen that I have really been looking forward to talking with. We know their names because of the articles written by and the shows, the guest appearances by Michael Sala. And he's exposed to us the fact that, exposed to the world the fact that his information for his articles and report came from Clay and Sean Pickering, and they are online with me. Let me begin by saying, Sean, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Kevin, for having me.
And Clay, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Now, you guys are in what part of the country?
New York City.
All right. Now,
right in the middle of Manhattan.
Well, that puts you in close proximity to the United Nations building, then. How far is it from you?
How many blocks is that, Sean?
Well, the UN is at 1st Avenue, 41st Street, and we're 19th Street and 8th Avenue. So I would say about maybe 6 or 7 avenues over and 20 blocks up. So we're probably within about a mile and a half, I'd say.
So you are the guys. You're the ones who are the fountainhead of the information about the source. In other words, the source talked to you. Is that correct?
Well, I'm gonna hand this over to Clay because it was Clay that was the person that he first met. So, Clay, why don't you?
Sure, Sean. I'll try to inform Kevin and the audience exactly how we met. I had stated in detail on one particular forum, Open Minds Forum, exactly how we did this. So I'll try to do this as best as possible, Kevin, and try to be as succinct as possible in how we met our guy. But it was just a little over 2 years ago when Fleet Wheat was in that the owner's brother, son, who just joined the Marines, and
when you say the owner of what?
Yeah, the owner of the establishment, the restaurant bar in which I work at.
Okay.
And his brother's son was deployed to Haditha, Iraq, at the time. So when Fleetwood was in, we were going to extend the courtesy to all the men and women, Navy and Marines primarily. And invite him in and have a drink on the house. But as the day wore on, there was a gentleman that walked by, and he's in the Navy, and I cannot give his rank just for safety reasons and security. I think you understand that. But I invited him in for a drink, and I said, sir, would you like to come in and have a drink on the house? And a very gregarious gentleman, very, very, very nice. And he said, sure. So he sat at the bar, and we proceeded to talk a little bit about politics. I asked about his background. The gentleman goes all the way back to 1968. He fought in Vietnam, and he essentially retired around 85, 86, but they keep bringing him back, which is interesting in itself, because of the position in which his associations with the black world kept him within the military. So that's another story. But as we're sitting there having a drink, he asked me a little bit about myself and my brother. And we got into a conversation a little bit about just politics in general. And he asked me what my primary area of interest was. And I said that my brother and I have primarily centered on the UFO ET paradigm. And with that, Kevin, he shot me a look that I'll never forget. And it wasn't a look of denial. It wasn't a look of ridicule. It was a look of genuine interest. And the next question our source asked us was, have you been out west? And I knew what he meant by that. And I said to him...
What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I read into it. Have you been out west meant, have you ever been out by the Area 51 facility?
Okay.
So I said to him, my answer, by that, do you mean, have I been to Rachel? And he looked at me, he said, yes. And I said, my brother, Sean, his twin, fraternal, Sam, and myself have been out to Rachel twice. And he was very interested in that. So with that came the introduction of our source with a little bit of the ET UFO paradigm. Now, we didn't get too deep into the UFO issue at that time, but he was generally interested. He said, well, I think this is real. And he said that I think this is, I think I remember him saying that he believed that generally the ET paradigm is, at least in terms of the visitation, is primarily benevolent. And with that, we had an ongoing conversation. My brother joined me later that day. And with that, as we got to know the gentleman, he slowly started to disclose a little bit more information each time. Just a little bit more. A little bit more background. A little bit more this. A little bit more that. It wasn't something that he poured forth the information all at once. And there was a trust that was built up. And essentially, that's where we are today. And I think that as far as an introduction, as far as our source getting to know us, he developed a trust for us. I think he respects us. And this is other than the UFO ET issue, because we talk about politics in general, especially political intrigue. And I think this is, even to this day, we you know, we go back and forth, sometimes quite heated, but with respect. And we... This is our primary interest, but this is where we're at. Do you have anything to add, Sean?
Yeah, well, I think what really got it going was he had said, I actually have in my possession a copy of a crash retrieval manual. And Clay said, that's interesting.
That was, just to clarify that with Kevin and Sean, that was roughly about a month and a half, 2 months after we met him.
Correct. But that really got it going. So we said, yes, we would love to see the manual. So he brought in, a week later, he brought in a copy of the Special Operations Manual 1-01, which Clay and I both, we were both familiar with that document. It was the one that was released in...
94. The Jamie Chanderay, Bill Moore. That was the 35-millimeter copy that was mailed to...
Yeah, but however, this particular copy was a different... copy of the same version. It was an earlier copy, and that gets into the story of how we procured that copy.
So you have
that copy. I'm sorry?
So you have it now.
Yes, we have a copy of that manual. It's been sent to Dr. Bob Wood. He has analyzed it. He has noted certain differences in this particular copy than the one in 94, the Chandera copy. And he was very intrigued, but he really wished we had an affidavit connected to it, and that's very difficult at this point because our source is still active. So that being said, we had it analyzed by Bob, and he was very intrigued. He saw the differences. And what's interesting is the story behind that document, how we got it. And that happened in the early 80s, right around the 82, 83 time frame. What happened was he was out west, and they were he was part of the a team that did monitoring of missile tests.
Yeah, missile tests, essentially.
So they were out west, and there was, I can't give you the specific bases involved because I don't want to narrow down the field too much, but it was out west, and apparently one of these missiles went errant. And it went well past its fail-safe drop point. And so he was tasked, along with two Marines, to go find it. So they were out very, very late. They traveled for hours and hours and hours looking for it, trying to pick up the transmitter's signal. In those days, it was a certain signal. It was a low-level signal, so the Soviets wouldn't pick it up. But so they kept driving and driving and driving. And at one point, our source said, oh, my gosh, we're essentially in a classified area. So they figured they were very close to finding the missile, but they couldn't. It was too dark, so they said, well, let's wait in the morning. We'll do a visual, pick it up, and get the heck out. So they were they bedded down about 11 p.m., and about 2 a.m. in the morning, they were awoken by a rush of wind, but no sound. And they looked up, and they saw this black triangular craft go above them in a step-like motion, but it's completely silent.
As it descended in a step-like motion.
Yes, and there were red lights on both the port and starboard side.
No, red light port, green light.
Excuse me
if I did that. Said that right. Red light port, green light starboard. Excuse me.
The two Marines freaked out, but our source pointed up to it and said, "No, it's one of ours. It's one of ours." Soon after, two F-15s raced overhead, and then within 5 or 10 minutes. The helicopters came, and they were first. The first helicopter came was an AH-64 helicopter, And then the Blackhawks arrived.
AH-64
is Apaches, as we all know.
Yeah. All right, now, the reason he said it's ours is because of the red and green lights, directional lights.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That was his. He ascertained that based on those on the warning lights on crafts. We're assuming that our source may have seen. I don't know at that point. May have seen. Let's just say a disc technology, or just the fact that the lights were on the craft. Was a supposition that I think that any airman would make.
Yeah, I think primarily though he saw the starboard and port lights, and he said to himself, "Oh, you know, that seems to be ours." So the Blackhawks had arrived. They brought the two Marines and our source in the Blackhawks. They flew them out to an area, a secured facility. And it had about an 18,000-foot runway, and I think you know which facility I'm talking about. It had three or four hangars they could see, and they were blindfolded. They exited the helicopter, and they entered what he believed to be the hangar. He walked into an elevator and descended. And I said, "Well, how far did you descend?" He said, "Probably about 200 feet because his ears popped." And then at that point, he felt he was separated because he no longer heard the Marines. And he felt he was by himself because he didn't feel like he was in contact with any of the Marines that originally went with him.
Well, he's still blindfolded, right?
I'm sorry?
He's still blindfolded, right?
At this point, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know at what point the blindfolds were taken off, but eventually they were taken off because he was able to describe the people that did the interrogation.
Correct.
And that was, he felt he was there for 3 days because he had three different interrogators. He said they were very polished, very well educated. In fact, he described them as Midwesterners Fort Detrick types.
Sean, just hold that 1 second. I just want to clarify something, too. Before he was picked up by the AH-64, the Apaches or the Blackhawks, we guessed, and he wasn't sure at this point, but he told us that it was probably the western side of the Nellis Air Force Range. So we suspect it was a Tona Tespa range where he originally saw the triangular shaped aircraft, and where he was detained and arrested at that point. And when he was brought into the Area 51 facility, correct me if I'm wrong, Sean, I think he had a bag over his head.
He just said he was blindfolded.
Okay, blindfolded. I think that he may have told me that a little bit later. But okay, go ahead, Sean. Pick it up.
At this point, he was interrogated by three different interrogators. They did the good guy, bad guy technique. There was sleep deprivation involved, water deprivation, harassment, threats on his life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They kept on asking him, what did he see, what did he see? And he kept on saying he didn't see anything. It was deny, 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 deny. And he credits this to his survival training that he'd gone through.
That was his he specifically said his Fort Lewis interrogation training, which I found very specific. And I know that I think there's some people out there would know that Fort Lewis is involved in psychological warfare. That's Fort Lewis, Washington State.
Yeah, actually, it was interrogation training, not survival training. But I guess that's a subset of the survival training if you get pulled in as a prisoner of war. So he was interrogated in sleep deprivation, harassment, water deprivation, and he was there for, he believes, 3 days. He asked for his CO. They said that the CO wasn't taking the calls. He knew that was, as they say, BS. And so he held out, and they even put a picture in front of him where he's looking up in the sky, so you've got a picture of him pointing up at the sky and say, "That's you." So they actually have a picture of him pointing up
now,
at the time that the craft had gone over before they were detained. He says, "That's you." And he says,
"How did they
me.
Do that if the helicopters didn't arrive until a few seconds, a few minutes
later?" That's
interesting.
Later. Mm-hmm. I asked him that question. I don't remember getting a specific answer, but there was the picture of him.
So the question is, did they take the photograph from the triangular-shaped aircraft? I remember I asked our guy this, and what was his, I don't
know. Or did they take it from a satellite position in space? I don't know, because they do have that resolution. But he denied it was him. And he said, that's you. He goes, no, that's someone who looks like me. And, oh, he also said that he had been given drugs. And he said he was kind of lucky because he had kind of an outer body of experience. When he saw himself, he said, that's someone that looks like me. So it was almost organic the way he said it. And he said, you know, quite frankly, he was kind of lucky that he responded that way. So he denied. 3 days after what he believed was 3 days, he was finally released, and he was flown out of there, I believe, by a Chinook.
Yes, he was flown out by Chinook, and he was flown south so that the listeners can understand you're not flown north. East or west. He was flown south towards the actual Nellis Air Force Base facility, and then he was flown west. Now, I'd just like to clarify again that our source came from another undisclosed base in which that he encroached into the Area 51 Nellis Air Force Base Tonopah test range. So he's being flown back to the origin from the base in which he came.
So he's flown back to his base, the base we can't name, and at that point his CO takes him into his office, sits him down, he opens up the cabinet, there's single malt scotch there, he goes, I think you're going to want a drink, and he pulls out a single malt and actually pulls a tumbler full of the single malt scotch in the glass, and he said, I'm going to be out of the room for 20 minutes. He looked over to the safe. The safe was open. He said, now I'm going to be gone for 20 minutes. Okay? And then when I come back, we'll talk. So, and they looked back over the safe. He goes, okay, I'll see you in 20 minutes. So obviously he was telling him he's going to be out of the room for 20 minutes. So our source walked over. He looked in the safe, and he saw three manuals, two of which were unopened. Clay says four manuals.
There's four manuals.
Three. Okay, we'll say four. I remember three, but we'll say four. Three of which were unopened, but one was opened. Now, he had his training and his common sense told him, don't open the unopened manuals, because once you open a manual, you can't unopen it.
He opened the remember, Sean, he took the third one from the top. So, one, two, three.
Okay. But that was the one that was already open.
Right, exactly. It was the one that was somewhat dog-eared.
And you also know when you touch manuals, the oil in your fingers gets on the manuals. He didn't want to touch anything that was completely unopened, so he grabbed the manual that had been opened, and that was the SOM-1-01 document. And if you lift the cover up, you see all the COs who signed. They have to read the manual, and they have to sign in on it. So he made a copy. That's where the copy comes from.
For those who don't know what the SO-1-01, essentially, it's a guide for the retrieval of extraterrestrial biological entities and craft. It's extraterrestrial entities and technology recovery and disposal. Just so you know, and that's the copy in which our source.
Yeah, that's the document he copied. So the CO came back in the room. He said, listen, all your clearances have been pulled, and you're going to be basically shipped out to Washington. You're going to get a cushy job escorting people to functions, and you'll be gone in 30 days. And he was upset because he liked what he did, the electronic end of things, monitoring, and that he had 6 months left on his billet. So he said, well, you're going in 30 days. So he had all his clearances pulled, and he knew his career in that specific area was over. And at that point, I think a day or two later, the Marines came in.
Oh, no,
two weeks later.
2 weeks, Sean.
It was two weeks later.
He even suspects it might have been even three, if he remembers correctly.
Right.
Between 2 and 3 weeks.
The Marines came in, and they were messed up.
Okay, tell you what we got to do. We're going to have to hold that story about the Marines until we get back from break, because the break is about to take over. All right, folks, I told you this would be a great show. Was I right?
such a sweet, sweet thing to lay. Got a hold of me. I open doors for little old ladies. I help the blind to see. I got no friends cause I read the papers. They can't be seen with me. I'm feeling real shut down.
We're talking with Sean and Clay Pickering this evening, and they're telling us about what led up to their information about this UN meeting on UFO disclosure.
So when we had to take the break, you said the Marines had come back. They got back to the base, and they were messed up, right?
They were messed up, Kevin. I mean, psychologically, they were a wreck. Physically, they were wrecked. They had black and blue knee marks all over their arms as if the needles that they were injected with were improperly injected. And our source never knew what happened to those guys. What happens when you have an incidents like this in any of these facilities is they separate everybody. They ship everybody every which way, and you never see these people ever again. I think George Filer mentions
right,
that
exactly.
In the McGuire Air Force for
1967 instance where they shot an extraterrestrial on the Fort Dix tarmac. They transferred everybody out so that there's a plausible disclaim, there's compartmentalization, and there's nowhere to take the story if the press caught on.
Yeah, standard operating procedure.
Right.
So our particular source, he was shipped out to Washington. He was a liaison with the State Department, I believe, and he was supposed to take, you know, attend functions and do very cushy stuff, which actually, at this point, our source did not want to do. He really loved his job. But he felt very uncomfortable about what happened to him out west.
Well, hold on to that story, Sean. Okay, well, you're going to go back to that. But when we saw our source again, at that point, I said to him, I said, this doesn't make sense. You kept your mouth shut during interrogation. You'd be a perfect candidate to work at the facility. Why didn't they upgrade your clearance and keep you there and move you into maybe another program? I said, it doesn't make sense. And he said, well, it didn't turn out that way. They ended up shipping me to the State Department, and I ended up working in that particular venue. So I said, okay. Now, with that, Kevin, is that our source came back about a month and a half later with his album. So I saw his complete military history, along with another gentleman that was with us, Bob Vanderklok, who also knows our source. Bob was Army Intelligence.
He's done a lot of work on the Roswell
right.
material.
Exactly.
Bob, new Corso.
Bob was Army Intelligence in Southeast Asia, worked under General Westmoreland. He was a Vietnamese translator. So Bob, like Sean just mentioned, Bob is an expert in the Roswell venue, and he has personally met Corso. He has personally met
and interviewed
many,
him.
Yeah, and interviewed him exactly on two occasions with Linda Moulton Howe. But with that, he
just
came.
Just to stay in the linear aspect
sure.
of it, Clay's going to segue eventually to why you would have been a perfect candidate. But just to stay in the linear aspect of it, mm-hmm. when our source went out east to Washington D.C. and he did this cushy job, he felt very uncomfortable what happened to him out west. And so he felt that he needed a little protection. He wanted to get his story down and sealed and put in a very safe place so that if something would happen to him, he would have a little bit of an insurance policy. So he went down to Falls Church, Virginia, and to the JAG office, and he gave an affidavit about what happened. And present, initially, a present at the affidavit was a commander. A lieutenant commander was also there, and a chief petty officer who was a female.
She was a stenographer.
She was a stenographer, correct. And so he started recounting about what happened. The second he mentions the name of the secure facility, the commander said, stop, cut it, stop. And he told the petty officer, the chief petty officer, to leave the room. And she left the room, and he turned to our source, goes, she doesn't have clearance. And in came another chief petty officer who was a male. And he says, okay, now you can continue. So our source continued, and he gave his affidavit. And every about a minute or two, the commander would stop and goes, are you sure you want to do this? He goes, yes, I do. So they continued. And a few minutes later, are you sure you want to do this? Yes, I do, responded our source. So they finished the affidavit. There were three signatures on the affidavit, the commander, the lieutenant commander, the chief petty officer, and then obviously his signature, and that particular affidavit was wrapped up in protective material and stowed away. So he finished, did his Washingtonian gig, and then I'll kind of segue, and Clay, go ahead.
All right, this is where it gets a little bit murky, because as I said, is that during his interrogation, he kept his mouth shut, and that's everything. That means under duress, he can keep the secrets, so to speak. So when I saw our guy again, I said, this doesn't make sense. They should have upgraded your clearance and probably brought you into another program, and that's where you should be. So about a month later, he brings in his album. And I was the first to see it, and then later, Bob Vanderklok, Army Intelligence, as I mentioned, Bob Morningstar, Vice Commander, United States Coast Guard Reserves here in New York, who's been instrumental in helping us get this information out. And Sean, I'm trying to think if there's anybody else. But anyhow.
Jim Morris.
And Jim Morris has, not seen his album.
No, not seen his album, but
so,
it has helped us.
But, yes, and Jim Morris has helped us, but as far as seeing the album. So, with that, as we were going through his album, and we got to the last two pages, lo and behold, there are two IDs. One of them is an aluminum security ID. It says Area 51. It has a thumbprint, it has a barcode, and it tells the person, or the officer or enlisted personnel, how to wear it on the body, at least on the upper left hand portion of the chest, from what I remember. But below that was also another security ID for parking. And I said, "You son of a gun!" He goes, "I didn't know what to say at that point, and I wanted to feel you out and find out where you guys were at. But yes, I worked there for 6 months." I said, "I'm not surprised, but I'm surprised." And he said, well, I'm surprised you picked it up. And I said, well, it just makes sense that if you kept your mouth shut, why didn't they upgrade your security clearances? Do you have something you'd like to add at all?
No, you're fine.
So with that, we went through his album. I said, wow. And then he got into some of his experiences at the Area 51 facility. And like Bob Lazar, our source did not know Bob Lazar, by the way. Nor had heard of him at that point. He had heard of him much later because of the media attention on Lazar. But he said it is a very, very impressive environment. And where he worked, I think it was called the Military Support Group.
Did you say it's a very impressive or oppressive?
Oppressive. Very oppressive.
Oppressive. Okay.
Yeah. Very oppressive, oppressive. Kevin, and he wasn't at all happy being there, and he looked forward to getting out of there.
Yeah, I would say the only inconsistency I've ever gotten out of the testimony from our source is the exact description of this facility. It changed a little bit, and he could have purposely done that to protect any classified information. But I'll just go on what he told me. He said that the levels he knew about, there were 12 levels to the facility, and he had access 1 through 6. And once you go from 6 to 12, you get into the biological aspect of it, which he didn't have access to. He was part of what they call the MSG. It's either Military Support Group or Military Services Group. I don't remember. But I remember the letters being MSG,
right.
And he provided all the logistical stuff to certain aspects of the facility. That was his job. He did mention that he had one encounter. Do you want to get into that, Glenn?
Just briefly, but he wasn't sure until we had he was sure that the encounter was extraterrestrial, but it's essentially a very Nordic. It was a female, I believe. Not curvaceous in any way, very linear, very straight, symmetrically.
As if she had no derriere.
Right. And he was sure that it was an extraterrestrial in the encounter, but it was very confusing to him. And it wasn't really until later, until we introduced the Charles Hall information, the tall whites, that he actually phoned back and said, you know, son of a gun, that looks very much like what I saw, but not quite.
He actually thought he had a conversation with this. He described it as a female, but he realized that he didn't. It was actually the conversation was entrained through the particular ET's placement of the finger, the thumb behind the ear, and the index finger by the throat, or something like that.
Yeah, he's a little unsure of that, but he felt it was telepathic.
Right.
On that issue, but what else would you like to?
So he described a little bit about his stay at Area 51 to be very oppressive. When you go from level to level, you have to give an iris scan, you have to give a thumbprint scan, and you have to type in the correct code. And if something goes wrong, your face is down on the ground, you got a rifle to your head, and you know they can shoot to kill. I mean, and get away with it. And that kind of environment, and again, this also gets back to what Bob Lazar, who had spent some time at Area 51, doing a little reverse engineering work there, he described the same situation, that it's a very, very oppressive environment that these facilities, that it's not from an old fact that the entire black world is kind of tired of the oppressiveness of their lives, and you know, people who come into the black world, and you really lose control of the life that you're in. You're in it. It's kind of like, I guess, the mafia. You know, you can never ever get out.
Yeah, he couldn't wait to get out of there.
You know, that was intriguing of him
as we were talking about this information. He just didn't like it. And like I said, he said computers have glitches when you're down there. If you have a glitch when you're trying to get in to one area, it's a very scary proposition because these guys are trained to kill.
Yeah.
Guys, we have to take a break.
Sure.
And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes here. And it's kind of like Hotel California. You can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave. We'll be right back.
We are back. My guests this evening are Clay and Sean Pickering. And guys, I had to cut you off in mid-sentence, but let's continue. This is becoming quite intriguing.
Yeah, so basically this has been the background to our sources' entry into what is known as the black world. He's actually at specific times related about being involved in it. You know, you get your life essentially taken away from you. You're controlled, and a lot of people, to reiterate, a lot of people within the black world are very unhappy about the secret nature of it, the oppressiveness of it, the danger of it. This is the choice that at some point that they made, and they have to kind of live with it. But I think, our relationship with the source continued for the next year. He actually was away overseas.
As I said to you, Kevin, we have to be very, very careful. We don't divulge anything that can narrow the field, because he's at that. This is a difference between some of the whistleblowers who have, at least security clearances have expired. this gentleman's security clearance will never expire. And as I mentioned, he may have retired. Besides his condition at 85, he is never retired, if you know what I mean. Because once you're in the black world, there's always a need at some point in time for your services because of what you've done. And this is how compartmentalization works. This is that simple as that. And that particular person may have the special access that others cannot get, so they're called upon. And that's
the reserve. Even people that retire. And unbeknownst to them, their classifications are extended. They actually may have points for you.
And then how would that be said? When the Iraq War, the Afghanistan-Iraq War, took off, there was definitely a need for bodies in the field. And as I said before, our guy is a Vietnam veteran. And his expertise in the area in which he's familiar with that was required in Afghanistan. The Navy at the time did not have a viable intelligence operation to find out what the hell was going on in Afghanistan. So with that, he spent about 6 months there, and we emailed each other back and forth pictures that he knew, but nothing sensitive and nothing classified. But just kept in contact with what was going on. And when he finally came back, it took a bit of time to decompress. At MacDill Air Force Base, Air Force Base, I believe, in Florida. But and then we saw him after that point. And he was quite disheartened. He really wanted to, at this point, get out. I think the Afghanistan experience really sullied his look at what our foreign policy in terms of war and what's going on in that part of the world. And matter of fact, he was given the medal of allegiance. He just wasn't proud of that at all. And he, from what I understand, the other people in the military are not very proud of that medal because it's not something that they felt it was earned, that it was part of that their real military duties were. But with that being said, he came back and he wanted to. However, if you were
along here, time passed, and I guess to really pick up the ball and get this thing rolling, with Stephenville, incident happened to you, Ira incident happened to you, this is bad. So we're around the table talking to each other, what do you think about those incidents? And he kind of looked, waited for such a change or something, and I said,
let me just interject. This is February 10th, 2008, guys.
Right. So he said, I didn't answer your question. I said, well, I thought you weren't interested. He said, oh, I was very interested. And at that point, he got up. He goes, excuse me, you went outside and you made a phone call. And so Clay and I are looking at each other and like, he actually was at the place that Clay works. Clay and I are looking at each other and felt a bit odd and came back. He said, okay, guys, essentially, I guess he said, what do you think?
He came back and he said, mission accomplished. I'm not defined that so I could
read that to you really quick. All right. But anyway, so he said, look, tomorrow, I'm going to a meeting at the UN, and it's an 8 o'clock meeting. He said that's very unusual because they never have 8 o'clock meetings at the UN. It's usually much later. And we're going to be talking about, part of the discussion will be about these sightings. And part of it will be, part of my job is to let certain people connected to the meeting know that the sightings did not involve our technology, and that there was not a U.S. Intrusion into any sovereign space. And he said, do me a favor, don't put this out there until that thing happens. I was given permission to tell you guys, from an admiral, to tell you guys to release it to the UFO community at the meeting. Was to take place, or had taken place, and that he was going to debrief us in a very limited way. He did not go into great
that's about the sensitive areas of the knee is very, very gentle, but he gave us enough information whereby the UFO community would take note and would realize that this was what would be termed a controlled leak, a leak that would not compromise that security, but a leak that would perhaps send signals out into the community, but also into the military-industrial complex community, that there is a certain element that wants disclosure. The big problem has been over the last year or so is the confusion between disclosure and leaking. Leaking is a process whereby information is put out there to entice, to foster an atmosphere for disclosure. And I think a lot of people in the UFO community misjudged that, and so they became very, very impatient. They wanted to know the source's name, they wanted to know who was in the meeting, they wanted to know the topic of the meeting, they wanted to know what time it was held, when it was held. And these are all very, very naive questions to be asking because of the sensitive nature. I'll just go down the list. The meeting itself, which we released to the public after the meeting had taken place in February. This particular memo was written in 20 February.
Just to clarify, if for our audience, the cabinet said we had met him on February 10th. February 11th, that was a Monday, 8 o'clock at night. And he was going to be at the UN at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, if I remember correctly. And seven o'clock in the morning, he had to be there very early. So that was very unusual to have a meeting at that site that early in the morning. So just to get the ball rolling, I'm going to do the bullet points of that specific meeting. Tuesday the 12th, 2008, beginning at 8 p.m. Eight a.m. Number one, he said the meeting went well. However, our source led to a degree of frustration. The meeting covered various topics. The issue of the recent UFO sightings was one of many topics discussed, and we put this out there very clearly that it was not the sole topic discussed. It was one of many discussed. The security around the meeting was intense. Everyone was searched. Pens, pins, keychain items were collected and not allowed in the meeting room. There were multiple security checkpoints, and U.S. security cards were confiscated upon entering the room. There were 50 or 60 people in attendance. Everyone was in civilian dress except a Russian or two. There might have been two military people in uniform. Other countries may have had military there, but they came under their respective civilian titles and dress. The UFO cockpit was addressed. Our source said that the Russians are very paranoid about the West. Putin is not very trusting. This frustrated our source greatly. Our source believes that the Russians will eventually come around. They always come back to the table. This mistrust appears to be an ongoing issue between the East and West, even after the end of the Cold War. Point 8, religious implications of contact came up during the meeting to turn into a 20-minute debate.
Okay, I don't want us to go any further into this until we come back from break, because that's a good place for us to break right there. All right, folks, we'll be back more with this report from Clay and Sean Pickering on their contact with the source of the information about this meeting at the UN. I told you this was going to be a great week. Remember last week I told you we had a great week lined up for you. And good soon. Hang in there.
Go. Point nine says that
the date of 2013, things will be heating up in terms of sightings and contact. If by 2017, this is the date, this will be the date that we get into our source that there will be contact. There will literally be ships that are popped over certain cities. They won't be doing anything. He described it as an independence-type day event. However, the craft are not that big, and there will be no violence. They're not going to do anything. They're just going to sit there. And that being said, the particular extraterrestrial that will be coming here is very concerned about the population of the planet, its effect on the flora and the fauna of the planet. And they made it very clear in a previous meeting that our service actually attended with five other gentlemen.
Inter-service working group. It's not Navy. It's Navy, Army, Air Force, Marines, all roughly the same rank, same age. We found out later that there was a meeting before. This is 2 weeks before the UN meeting that this is an undisclosed military base that our source has no knowledge of. The particular extraterrestrial species was, in fact, at the secure facility, and he briefed this six-man team about this contact date. This is where this 2017 date comes from. And they were very concerned about population deviation. They will not see the human race with technology to feed a population that may go from 6 billion to 10 billion.
Also, the fact is that according to ET, this seems like the war. The world is at war. That's another issue besides environment. But also, the chemical, biological, nuclear issue is unacceptable in terms of depopulating the planet. So, it
won't affect the arrival of the 2017 date, but it may affect whether they stay.
That's according to us. So
in our initial release of this information, that seemed to be a sticking point. People didn't really understand that the 2017 date would happen unless there's something completely entropic that happens in the planet where there's a nuclear war and, contact would get messed up anyway. But barring that, the 2017 date was the date that particular extraterrestrial race gave this small group to basically hand over this information over to this 50-60 person group, and
they can do that knowledge at least.
There's a few other points here, but they're not as important.
But they try to keep it moving on. Kevin, it's just very important. I got to get through because the biggest question is that how in the heck can these guys walk into the UN and have a secret UN UFO meeting? Now, obviously, there's not a title in the law book or above the conference room that says secret UN UFO meeting. So, what just came out today, Bob Morningstar and Sean and myself, and certain quotes by our source to explain exactly how it's done. And at UFO Digest, it's the title's on current UN UFO meetings, how cover works. So I'm just going to cut to the chase. And I'm reading exactly how our source conveyed how cover works. Let me just begin very quickly. In speaking with our source, I asked him to clarify his title and those of other foreign diplomats in respect to what we know as, quote, working groups, close quote. Our source stated his group and the groups of people abroad share similar function that they are not diplomats per se, as we understand it. Source stated that he and other foreign diplomats are, quote, this is source's quote, military diplomatic liaison officers assigned to the diplomatic corps, close quote, who are tasked under auspices of such entities which are analogous to what we know as the State Department. These men and women are not ambassadors, nor are they permanently assigned to titles of diplomats such as Bolton, Brenner, or Albright. Indeed, these officers are all military officers and are not staffers to the civilian diplomatic corps.
Now, I understand completely how that works. I had a diplomatic passport. I was a diplomatic observer in Kosovo, and I was chosen to be a diplomatic observer because I was an international police officer in my airline mission. So in that capacity, I went as a diplomatic observer.
Very good, Kevin. Let me just continue that. So that's important because, as you all know, there's many functions and many hows and wheres and whys how this works. So let me just continue very quickly. It is important to note with regard to our service that these people liaise between the Pentagon, that's the DOD, and the United Nations by way of the State Department. No one from the military can be received at the United Nations without State Department approval. The United Nations, to be understood, represents a neutral ground for likewise to talk without being noticed by the press. In turn, foreign liaison officers follow the same diplomatic protocols in order to gain entry into the UN. Those meetings are not what most people think is General Assembly or Security Council forums. How do these liaison officers decide to meet? By way of back-channeling. First, they explain that what most people don't understand is that phone calls are made to their respective counterparts on a need for a meeting. This meeting would be conveyed as, quote, informal items of interest, close quote. This communication would be passed on to other counterparts, and this is how the ball starts rolling. A good example of this is Robert Kennedy's informal back-channeling to a friend of the Soviet ambassador for a meeting concerning the Cuban Missile Crisis. I believe RFK met his liaison in a bar. Keep in mind, though, that everything has to have a, quote, budget line item, close quote. Nothing gets done without people getting paid to where they want to be at CUN unless there is an explanation and a reason why. To point, source, quote, even people in the black world have to get paid, close quote. Being paid to be somewhere has the benefit of legitimacy and also offers plausible display as leaks occur. Source A mentions this over and over again, this variable about being paid. What he is saying is to, quote, fault money, close quote. If you want your proof, close, that's a quote, of the if you want your proof of the UN UFO meetings. Now, once the officer has a budget line item to be at the UN and liaise with other foreign counterparts for a specific meeting, this is where the back-channeling comes to the forefront, and no one in the UN is wiser. Once that door is closed, anything and everything can be talked about. With our source, it has been 5 meetings on the UFO PT topic. What is the objective? These military liaisons under diplomatic cover enable the intervention of policy ideas and decisions. This form of communication is sensitive and allows the State Department Corps to put out feelers on volatile subjects and plausibly deny if it becomes public. This also facilitates for all parties concerned a way to begin a foundation for future policies and a working model for a time when discourse becomes finally becomes public. That model is a UFO ET paradigm, and that's very important for our listeners to understand exactly how these guys back-channel. They back-channel.
And of course, this is a lot of the National Security Act, you know. If you have a black budget, if you want to protect the gray programs, you have to tie the certain people involved in gray programs to that black programs as a way that covers the black program. But if they work in the gray, they can be prosecuted based on the black program. Thereby, they would never be prosecuted on the gray program, but if they compromise any of that information, they would be prosecuted based on their cover.
Well, it's a deal intelligence scheme that they call a limited hangout. You know, it's a limited hangout and a false flag. They need to know that you're a socialist within the purview of the black world, that you're associated with that, but then you're taking out and or you're participating in something that no one in your particular venue within the black world knows. Black world knows about it. Good cases, Dan Sherman's Project Preserve does say he gets into that, and that is accurate. That is exactly how it's done. Do you have something that else to add to that, Sean, or maybe Kevin?
I have nothing to add, except the phones are lighting up. I think probably we should open the telephone lines and take some calls. Line from the Kevin Smith Show, your first name and from where you're calling. How are you this evening?
I'm doing all right. The question I want to ask you guys actually tells you about when you're going to get disclosure, but I did have another question at the ready. Apart from what your source described as the tall lights, what other extraterrestrial species did your source relate to? I'll tell you exactly. Our source has heard but has never met the small gray or gray rocks. Definitely he has heard of that, and that's why I believe that he was at the Area 51 facility. He's conveyed that to us. From what we get from our source, he got some rich care for the grays. He,
conducive or friendly to us. Like, if you go and look at us like a bag of food, not very good, Mr. H. The other one is easy up at the hotel, Whiteboard Nordic, to be fair, is a reptilian. And a very interesting comment he made was nine times out of ten, when human beings are exposed to the reptilians, is that they have a very, it's a very emotional experience, and it really scares the daylights out of them. And our source, it was somewhat humorous, which I think in many respects he's famous, but don't get me wrong, he's not fearful, but at least in a certain venue with the ET, I think is the one reason why our source has been flustered along with this particular another ET race, which we call Informer, Controller, or other. And frankly, his American group does not have a name for this particular group. However, with that being said, when he first saw the reptilian, he actually kind of giggled and said, "You look like a snake." And the thing replied, "I'm not a snake."
Source described it as a kind of a bio suit on. Evidently, it didn't feel comfortable in our atmosphere. And he described the thing as very pointy. And the skin was not wet, but it looked reptilian. The skin looked reptilian in nature, but he said it didn't look wet or slimy or sticky or whatever.
I just want to make one point. We didn't get into it, but to give a quick description of the conformant, according to our source,
and this is the ET race that is going to show up in 2017.
Right. This particular race seems to have some degree of control, not total control by all means, but over the internet.
I'll say that the grays, the tall whites, and the reptiles defer to this particular race. And now it could be a situation where, they may be in power at the time. Like, for instance, we deferred to at one point Kofi Annan. It doesn't mean that Kofi Annan is above anybody. He just may be in that position. We don't know if there's a real hierarchy in place, but it seems like the gray, the reptilian, and the tall white race.
Yeah, that's at least four species that are, of course, not those of another. Could be quite more, and he even admitted that. But he said, "I'm not privy to that information, so I really don't know." Now, with the conformer, controller, or other, is that, and like I said, this inner service working group does not really have an inner. Maybe someone higher up, the policy groups, someone higher up the food chain might have an aid for this. But at least in terms of our source, they don't have an aid. However, this is a very blob-like, Play-Doh-type ET, and I tried to get a source built on this because I had a very difficult time explaining. He said this is not, in his opinion, interdimensional or ethereal. No, it's real. This is real. This is touch, smell, feel, that type of extraterrestrial. But it is blob-like Play-Doh.
It kind of exactly is formed.
Exactly. But here's the thing, is that this form, this extraterrestrial can hold the form for only a very short period of time based on the telepathic perception of the target. In other words, if our source is viewing this target, he will see what he wants to see in terms of the identity morphing to his perception. Now, it's still an extraterrestrial. And it's sort of like a telepathic contact or bridge between us.
It can maintain a human form for a short period of time when that's a literal human form manifestation, or it's an entrained manifestation in the mind of the viewer is not entirely clear, because there is telepathic activity happening. But when this particular ET entrains on you, it's very bright orange. When it dislocates from you, it no longer entrains on you, it turns into a dark red.
Okay, so with that, Kevin, I hope you try to clarify what the word controller can form and other. I just want to say, we don't know the name, and the word controller created quite a bit hubbub in the UFO community. Meaning, people were thinking, meaning that this ET race is here to control us, and from what we're getting from our sources, absolutely not. We made our bed, we've got to take care of it, we've got to fix it. If there's the word guidance could be used, then maybe, or yes, that needs to be determined, but we have the sense from our source that this
this is not interventionist policy by the EU. I would also add that I will also add one very quick point, that it is the ET race that decides who's going to be in the inter-services working group. That's not a decision that's made from any personnel, any human personnel. That's up to the ETs. If they request a certain person, that's the person you get.
Okay, Ken, do you have another question there so we can keep it moving?
Well, let me parse what I've just heard. The idea that they're not controlling us, and that's not their purpose, is somewhat nullified by the fact that whoever they say is going to be in the group is who we get. And they are definitely then in control of this situation.
They have control with the inter-services group. They have control, and that's only because the spiritual, emotional, intellectual reaction to it there is between human beings and this particular race. Now, it doesn't mean that if our source decides to not get involved in that, then that may be a different story. So it doesn't nullify our source's free will. It simply says that if he's requested, is it better?
Okay. All right. It's much more accurate. So the free will aspect seems to be a very high priority with this particular species, and they've made that known to the inter-services group, and our guys can pay that over a little bit to us. So we don't have a sense that there's any oppression or anything that against the will of the participants.
Well, that's certainly where our source is standing. Yeah, in terms of the 27 being, our source says, I like these guys. I like them. I don't want them to go away. That was kind of his emotional response and an intellectual response to his interaction with these things. So,
yeah, to clarify that, he said that we don't rip the clean up our house in terms of not having ET intervening and giving us technologies that would enhance our living conditions. And I think that's the ultimate purpose. However, I think that there's certain stipulations that have to be adhered to, that we have to take care of our planet. We can't have a runaway population. We can drain our natural resources. The fact is that to extraterrestrials and to anybody with an open mind, there's wars going on this planet. Everywhere, and there's certain things that we have to do spiritually with this planet, and take responsibility before there's let's just say there's a wholesale giving over of this technology. However, keep this in mind, is that we will not be tolerated in terms of handing technology over. We're not handing technology over as the use of the nuclear biological chemical warfare as a means to depopulate.
Let's go to the phone line. Calling the line on Kevin Smith's show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
This is Brent from Iowa.
Yes, Brent.
Kevin, I have a real quick question for you. Does your source have any clue, any ideas as to what kinds of people these ETs are looking for to make contact with them?
I would have to say I don't have an answer for that. I think that in terms of this particular extraterrestrial race and their agenda, I really don't know. I don't know.
I think our source said, okay, the Greys look at it as a bag of food. Not that they mean it as a use, I don't know. They could be, they could look at us as genetic material. There's been some school of thought out there that the Greys are interested in our DNA because they have a neuropathy that seems to be regressive, and they want to beef up their own biological substance. So they kind of look at us as fodder. That's their agenda. The tall whites have their agenda. This particular group, other than exposing our planet to the fact that the cosmos is a lot bigger than what humanity believes it to be, and that we have to start living within our means, That seems to be that's their agenda. And it seems that they're interested in lifting humanity up to an awareness that behind stabilization in how we consume food, how we consume resources, and how we procreate.
Well, you know, we've all heard about this. Agenda. That it's some people believe that it's absolutely true, and some people believe that it's a rumor. But we've all heard about this agenda that some super national, international group elites have to depopulate the planet.
Yes, you're talking about the global 2004 Prince Simon Francis, Victor Brzezinski, the National Security Studying Memorandum 200 by Kissinger and the National Security Directive 68, Victor Brzezinski, on the depopulation of Africa. And there are these programs out there.
And I think the feeling I'm getting from our source and those who's connected to this, they're very aware that the elite have their agenda. And I'll give you an example. For instance, if there is contact, okay, when the ships pop over cities, okay, they're very concerned about what's going to happen in minutes, the hours, the days, the weeks after initial contact. And one of the things they worry about is, what is the elite going to do with the money? Are they going to pull the money out and put it in something that's going to maintain the control base? And how will it affect the world economy? These are very, very real concerns.
You're saying the ETs are concerned about that?
No, I'm saying our working group.
Okay.
It's just the working group of policymakers who would like disclosure to happen are very concerned the fact there might be a sociological and economic breakdown of civilization. I mean, transportation.
I'm going one step further than that. I'm saying when contact happens, not just disclosure, but when contact happens, part of the working group's job is to reach out to this working bureaucratic level that then affects policy to create an atmosphere where you have some degree of stabilization, insanity, both minutes, hours, days, and weeks after contact.
Let me elaborate on this. I think Michael Sala and Bob Morningstar, we talked about this at length, was that part of this whole UN UFO initiative, to keep this in mind, is to create awareness. Aside from the acclimation program, which the UFO community understands and people associated understand, are looking at that larger paradigm. Unfortunately, the masses, it's completely off the radar. However, what's interesting is that what's happening with, as we all know, the Larry King Show, the Vatican, Morant issue, the 13th and 14th February meeting, our February 12th meeting, and subsequent meetings, ladies and gentlemen. But what's interesting is that that is creating a juggernaut to create a model for the policy-making decision and put pressure on the groups above, not necessarily below.
The objective, of course, is to get disclosure. Get people comfortable with the idea, and then you have to
talk about it. I'll use what our source says in the working group. Their objective is to crack this lid. I'm using the quote, crack this lid a little wider to help move this faster, because from what we're getting from our source and this particular extraterrestrial race is that there appears to be a timeline involved here that we have to get our act together if we want to improve our conditions on this planet.
Right, guys, we have to take a break, and let me say to the caller on hold, if you'll just hang in there, we'll be back with you shortly. When we come back from break, caller, we'll take you first thing, all right? We'll be back. Thank you.
The Kevin Smith Show audience is anxious to do business with the Blues who support the show. Sponsoring the Kevin Smith Show is just plain smart. Get your free media kit emailed to you today by sending an email to info@kevinsmithshow.com. That's adinfo@kevinsmithshow.com.
Call Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
Let's don't forget to get over to KevinSmithShow.com and subscribe to the K5RCs in our free weekly newsletter, all right? Absolutely free, no strings attached. You can unsubscribe anytime you desire to do so. So just go over to KevinSmithShow.com and look for the ad that told in big red letters. You can't miss it. K5's easy, all right? Let's go straight to the telephone and we'll come back to what you were talking about after this call. And I want to get to this caller. I promised I would call your first name and from where you're calling.
Hi, Kevin. Mark from Ashford, Ohio.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Sean and Clay.
Hello.
How are you, sir? And good. Have you ever heard of Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens?
Yes, we have.
I heard Wendell Stevens on another radio show talking about one of his contacts at the fort at the guard in Area 51. And according to Wendell Stevens, the guard in Area 51 also has an assassin. And his particular contact had 7-11 different assassinations over his career. However, that particular guard was told by his superior that he had contracted a terminal disease. But the guard knew that he was given this disease by his superiors because it was playing probably too much. Anyway, the guard did end up dying, but managed to tell one of his story. I just wondered if you might give a comment on this at all.
I can say this from our source. He said, you know, I'll be trying to be clear on this. He said that about 70% of the people in the military, people in general, have a great difficulty killing another human being unless put in a position where their life actually is threatened by it. And even more, they'll shoot around over their heads at something else other than killing another human being. Now, there's 20%. The sociopaths and the psychopaths. Yet the guys whose psychological profile would fit that particular type of executive action or network or neutralization, and I'd like to let the audience to get into neutralization, is intimidation, coercion, and termination. Those three. There are a group of people like that. And those group of people are controlled by the other 10%, and within that 10%, that's a 5%. A very small majority of people were able to utilize the fear factor and keep this particular issue going.
The question is asked, you know, will they use medical coercion to keep his people in mind? Yes, and that has actually happened to a similar scenario. He's met with a medical condition, and he had to get
had himself checked out to protect himself. I'm sure that if he overstepped the line, perhaps, you know, he could pass away with some a terrible disease that, that he may not have been aware of initially, and dies, I guess. It's like there's he kept when our source got back from his European tour speaking to other countries, Western European countries, about disclosure, which Italy and France were particularly interested, said, yeah, you know, we're interested in this in terms of the working groups, mind you folks, working groups, not the official government groups, but the working groups, the back channel groups. They said, yes, you go first. That's the issue here. You go first. And this has been talked in the subsequent UFO, the UN UFO meetings. You go first. China specifically said this to our source. But with that, our source got back. He was handed his medical file. And that medical file showed a 3-year heart condition that our source never had. And that means that there are preparations where people are noticing him, that in the event, from our source, yes, there are something at the source. They have plausible deniability. They have the necessary excuse to be able to explain it away.
Let's go back to the telephone line. John, you're alive on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Chris from Manhattan.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, guys, can I tell you real quick about this? I was wondering if there were any other benchmarks other than the time that you guys were given, up all of any other things to look for, maybe trying to find the fund or anything else like that that would help the disclosure process.
Disclosure project. I think we're seeing it now, guys, I gotta tell you.
Well, he said that our source said that in 2013, right, you start seeing a lot of suicides, you know, things are heating up.
Right. So, yeah, but also the ridicule factor, which has been very big, is that I tell you to folks today, we see the media stop ridiculing, and you're going to have disclosure.
Right.
As soon as that happens, then things will move along. The problem with impeding disclosure right now is a major disconnect with the mass media in terms of the UFO programming. There's always the ridicule factor. And until that's acknowledged and you take the ridicule factor out, then it's going to be very difficult to make the subconscious to the conscious shift that this is real. It's not that just ETs out there that everybody says, yes, we can't be the only ones alone. But what has to be acknowledged is that we are not alone. We have never been alone in this planet.
With regards to extraterrestrial life, the making process is being done to create a fertile ground for other areas within the national security structure to step forward. And then it creates a snowball effect. And then they start developing a policy initiative for disclosure. Then we'll get disclosure. And then what you'll do is you'll have a climatization process after disclosure to get people ready for the psychological impact of contact. Now, this is going to have to happen if the 2017 timeframe remains. It's going to happen between now and 2017.
So, I think I agree with the statement. I don't know if it was Sharon or Clay, I don't know which one made it, but it's already beginning. The benchmark's already happening.
I think it has, and I think what's happening now is that as soon as we get, and not to disparage, but the Joe Sixpack, and the females, okay, the women, the nest, as soon as the nest is disturbed, in each family, there is a dialogue taking place that, hey, you know, something's up. And that in turn transfers to the community and then onward. And then when that happens, I think that's when we're really going to see things move forward. And I think that is what our source is looking for in terms of the juggernaut.
But I think it's really how the media has begun to turn already. On my site, there is a link to the story. It's a report from Reuters about a UFO that exploded in Vietnam. There's no chuckle factor in it. There's no ridicule. It's just straight reporting. So it's beginning to happen. But you know, Joe Sixpack isn't going to get straight about this until as you say, there's a disturbance in the nest. In fact, that's not going to happen until the media, they've begun to turn, but until the media changes the focus. How many weeks did we hear about one new Britney saga after another?
Yes.
And who cares?
Well, it's the issue has to be addressed as soon as we get to young people. And that's a way to mitigate the importance of people over, say, 20, 30 years old. That's not it at all. But as soon as we get the focus off the pop culture and onto a particular issue, such as the disclosure contact, and get that moving, I think that'll be the... That'd be the real
scenario. The scenario I'm looking for is a typical, military structured scenario. So you have a line of military people, right? They're all standing in line, and the commanding officer will say, okay, who did it? And they're always the first person to step forward. And
exactly.
if we have a Spartacus situation, I'm Spartacus, all of a sudden we have a environment whereby it's now permissible to admit that this is a real phenomenon. And then when that happens, the media, which always follows, because the media is a social construct.
And right now, it's a social cancer.
I'm sorry?
Right now, it's a social cancer.
It's a cancer now, but it will jump on if permitted. Because, we've seen time and time again, when the media feels safe enough where they can jump in on that Toronto built to it.
And the day we get the Walter Cronkite, you know, the Dan Rathers, the Peter Jennings, and the Tom Brokaw, you know, the Walter Cronkite said the Vietnam War was lost, and the war was lost, I mean, that was lost. With regards to the perception of every American, when we can get that perception change to say, hey, maybe there is something to this UFO ET paradigm, that they're here, and it's happening, and let's crack that right up. And also, it all comes out.
Also, the mainstream media has to react to the internet. If the internet comes out to full force for non-disclosure and open this up, the media will have to follow, because it's losing day by day. It's losing its traction.
It sure is. It sure is.
You have another question? You have another question there, Kevin, so we can try to get as many as possible.
Yeah, the thing that I did have a question for the comment about the media. They are right now scrambling, trying to catch up with the parade, because the public has already passed them, and the public has already outrun the cover stories. And everybody that calls himself a leader and everybody that says that they are in the media is scrambling to catch up with the population. Maybe we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this.
Don't you worry about it.
Since 2000. Our audience has grown from zero to audience in 70 countries, making it one of the hottest shows on which to advertise. Put the power of the Kevin Smith Show to work for your own business. Advertising on this show is definitely one of the hottest ways to expose your business to the world. Request your free media kit right now and put the sizzle of this show to work for you today. Send your request to addinfo@kevinsmithshow.com. That's addinfo, A-D-I-N-F-O, at kevinsmithshow.com. Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
Call Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
All right, we are back, and we actually only have about 2 minutes left. And guys, I have a good question. The bigger question is, I can ask this in similar or and it's couched in a little different language, but similar forms. And I can ask this question. Over the course of many years now, the UFO community, those who investigate, those who research, those who report about UFOs, we know that has been, that community has been infiltrated from time to time by disinformation agents. What degree of confidence do you have that the information you were given by this source is straight and not disinformation?
I think it's an excellent question, Kevin. 2 years, many dinners, many drinks, specifics in terms of his life, in the above board military, specifics in his life in the black world, specifics in terms of certain events that he has told us about before they happened. I have been in his presence when admirals have called on many occasions. I believe Sean has even heard a place of the other end of the line. I remember one time when just before he was deployed to Afghanistan, he took a call from an admiral. I went outside my establishment. I couldn't find him. I found him huddled underneath the air conditioner. And I looked at him and I go, what the heck are you doing? And he pointed up to the sky. And he was actually pointing out, actually mentioned the fact that there's satellites up there that keep the position keep an eye on him. Also, the fact that on his key ring, he had a tracking device. So there's more than one aspect to this gentleman that I lay, and I think Sean does the same thing, with our guy.
Yeah, I think what I had noticed is how frustrated he gets when he really doesn't understand what he's trying to convey. What's important? I would see a guy that's manipulative. I see a guy that's desperately trying to get information out there, and people are just missing the target, and it frustrates him. This is not a guy that's looking to manipulate, to control people to look at it. This is a guy that's trying to influence people to move in the right direction, the direction that he believes in. I see genuine, authentic caring human being.
I agree with that, Joe.
All right, to answer your question, aside from the logistical observations we've made about who he is and what he is.
So from your point of view, everything that he's given you has been straight?
Yes, I mean, I think that I would say 98% of the stuff he's given us has been straight. The 2% is either a misperception on his part, or if we tread on information that may be way too sensitive, he may steer us slightly away from it.
I think you asked a very good question here, Kevin, is that sometimes information is tactical, and you got to be careful. Maybe you want to release some information to some confidence and for those confidential sources, Sean and myself and Bob Boyce and Michael Sellers, to get it out there. Sometimes you have to be very careful with the logistics of it because it might compromise an operation in progress, and that has weighed on our source many times. Where he said, "I can't say anything now, but I'll tell you that I'll wait, or something else will come up a little later, and he'll maybe give us a little bit, and he'll tell us in on it." So, like I said, it's been a relationship where there's trust. And don't get us wrong, we didn't follow the apple cart. We don't believe everything that Sarah said was measured against the context and the cumulative evidence of 60 years of denial with regards to this subject. And on the background of the geopolitical, our own research, and Kennedy's also met two other sources, two other researchers, right? Aside from Bob Van Clark, which I mentioned, Bob Winston and Michael Sauer. There are two of the top researchers out there in the field that everybody knows their name. Now, I cannot give that up because those two researchers do not want to remain anonymous. And I have mentioned one, and I think if you folks think, you probably figure out where to find it. But the other one, he wants to keep it, and our source wants to keep him off the radar because we would like to be able to use him as a point man at some point. So he's written a very respectable book, and his mind really suits the logistical nature of moving from leaking to disclosure to contact. But the other researcher, he actually met on base, in the airport with ID. So that helps.
So that researcher would be someone, if we heard the name, it's someone we would know.
Oh, yeah, both researchers, by the way, but the one that is out there a little bit and would like to remain off the radar, now that's a whole different thing than the first source, and it's a good thing with that researcher and our source, but we're not privy to that information only because I think that
Clay and Bob and I worked very hard for that to happen. They constructed the opportunity for that to happen.
Exactly. So, yeah, one more question, and there are a couple more that we get to, so.
Well, no, I don't have any questions. I have some observations. One of the things that I said on this show, I don't know if you've heard any of the previous shows that we've done on this, but we've had Michael Solomon, we've had Robert Morningstar on, and talking about this, one of the things that I've said is that if we know nothing else, We have the article that Sala did that exposes to us the agenda of that meeting, what was talked about, and what the plans were for acclimation and so forth. So we get that. Now, whether we believe that meeting took place or not, we can look at events since then and see that it appears that the agenda of that meeting has been implemented. It has begun.
Kevin, not only has it begun, and not to interrupt you, but there's been four other meetings. And what I learned was from our source, I said, nah, you're not going to do this to us again. He goes, yeah. He said, there's been four others. And one left is from 7 a.m. to
5 p.m. I wish we had time for that, but we're running up on the end of the show here.
Yeah.
I want to thank you guys for taking the time. I know you had very busy schedules, but you took the time to be with us. I want to thank you for that. And I would like, in the days ahead, for you to come back and tell us about these additional meetings and anything else that's transpired that's taking us down the road towards 2017. All right, if you would, just stay on the line with me, and I'll join you on the telephone right after we close the show. Ladies and gentlemen, my friends call me Steel-Eyed. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the crystal skulls. A lot of you saw that in Indiana Jones. Now, we've got someone coming on the show that has one of those crystal skulls. We'll be very interested to hear what he's got to say. Until tomorrow, so long, everybody. We'll be right back.